All right, today is June 19th, 2013. This is the second interview with Joe Solomons. We're here in his office inside the University Club. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Joe, I have a couple of questions from last time and a couple of questions I missed from last time before we move on to your outreach and the protests of 2011. The first actually goes back to you and your wife moving here to Madison permanently. So when you knew you got the full-time jobs and you were moving here permanently, where did you decide to live? And talk, if you can, a little bit about the transition of living in Lafayette to living in Madison. I should say West Lafayette, I'm sorry.
No, actually, so Purdue's in West Lafayette, we lived in Lafayette.
Oh, okay. I indirectly knew exactly what I was talking about.
So when we got married, one of the things about Lafayette is that real estate is incredibly cheap. And I was living in this little tiny house, and Monica said, "No, we need a somewhat bigger house." And so we were able, as beginning professors, to buy this 100-year-old Victorian that had been basically restored to the extent that a 100-year-old Victorian can be restored. And so we were living in this in this mansion, and got the job here when I was up as a visiting professor. I lived with her parents. Her father is now teaching still in his 80s in the law school, but has retired and has rehired Stuart McCauley. And her mother was an attorney in town. And he kept academic hours and she kept crazy lawyer hours, and I cook. And so for a semester, I lived in the house that she grew up in on the near west side, and late at night, would cook dinner for her parents. And so it was absolutely hilarious. It was really enjoyable semester. So we got the job and came looking for housing, and where we were able to comfortably buy this really cool Victorian in Lafayette, that wasn't a stretch. We found that modest housing was closer to a stretch. Ended up for a year on the far east side, and then thought we would stay there for a few years and keep an eye out, but was biking around getting to know Madison a little bit the first summer, and was just sort of keeping an eye out, and just started this thing of, I would jot down phone numbers if I saw something for sale that looked interesting, and found a place over on Monona Bay, and moved there and have lived there since. Spectacular location.
The other thing I want to talk about is the differences, and I think you touched on this a little bit, but specifically the differences of Purdue, the university, and then UW-Madison University, particularly as you got here and got initiated to it.
Well, I mean, obviously the all of the Wisconsin idea stuff that we talked about last time is very striking. Purdue's a land-grant university, and they take, under a certain interpretation, they take the land-grant stuff very seriously. They are famously and heavily oriented toward agriculture, engineering, things like that. So in that part of the land grant thing, they're very committed. And they have, if you're a farmer, there's lots of stuff happening. I don't think it's as much as is happening here. But it is not a comprehensive university in the same way. So when I got there as a faculty member, the holdings in linguistics were minimal, to put it mildly. And so I got used to just going down to Bloomington, 100 miles, nice drive. It's kind of small state highways, and pleasant. Even biked it. Go down there to use the library. Just go down on a Friday afternoon, spend the evening in the library, work on Saturday, and come back. Got to know people down there, so cheap, free place to stay and stuff like that. But Lafayette really didn't have any restaurants or anything, so even going to Bloomington was like, wow, Tibetan food, wow, Chinese food, wow, Indian food, Greek food. But, you know, you can't always go take a 100-mile trip every weekend, and sometimes you need stuff for longer. And I couldn't check out books. And so I got to know the people at Library Lowell extremely well. And I looked young in those days, to the point that when I got tenure, I was still getting the student loan period on books if I didn't specifically call attention to it a lot. And I went into Library Loan one day to fill out another stack of requests. And I said, man, I sure wish we had a better library. And the woman just looked up at me and said, you know, if you wanted a library in social sciences and humanities, you should have enrolled at Indiana. So the commitment there, I mean, linguistics has gotten very strong. It was there were things happening in linguistics, important good things happening at Purdue in those days, mostly in speech science, American Sign Language, things like that, stuff that sort of fit the natural mission as it was seen locally in the university. But language departments in particular at that point were being seen as service departments. You know, a sophisticated PhD in engineering needs to know how to read German because there's going to be some text in German or there's going to be some connection to a German company. And the graduate programs were small and limited. So master's students in German who were going to be local German teachers was most of it. There were a few PhDs. I actually had a few PhD students there. One who sadly just passed away this past spring, Dan Nutzel, had an endowed chair at Indiana Indianapolis, doing work on German as spoken in Indiana. So there were PhD students coming through, and a linguist in the English department and in speech and audiology to work with. So it was a rich environment, but it was kind of limited compared to here. You go from that to, I mean, it goes back to the very first things I said about what it was about. You ask why Wisconsin? Well, why Wisconsin? Huge tradition, huge history, the right vision of what a public university is supposed to be and how it's supposed to operate, not just in terms of service, but in terms of research and things like that. So I was delighted to get a job at Purdue when I came out of graduate school. Times were hard. That was a tenure track job. It was a Big Ten university. I knew people who were much better students and beginning scholars and teachers than I was, who ended up by accident or whatever, without jobs, certainly without jobs that good. So I was extremely grateful to have it, and it was not a bad thing. But I mean, here it was, going from what would have been a perfectly fine career to really the best place to be in the country. So it was stark. And you know, the fact that when I got to Purdue, there was one sort of American-Italian place, a couple of steak places, and there was a Chinese place that was horrible. And that was it, restaurant-wise. You could drive a ways and get a catfish joint and things like that. But if you wanted anything more than a breaded pork loin sandwich or a hamburger, it was pretty slim pickings. And you come to Madison, you know, and go out to eat with Monica's parents or when she was here. So, oh, what do you want? It's like, I literally couldn't make up my mind. It's like, well, I don't know. Like, Thai sounds good, yeah, but. You know, just down the whole list of things. And even going to the grocery store, when we got together, Monica set this rule that we would get out of Lafayette for part of a weekend every month. It turned out to be just this brilliant rule. We'd go up to Chicago, go down to Bloomington, go wherever, come to Madison, visit her family. But, you know, come Sunday morning, we're going to head home. Thing you do on the way out of town is you know which groceries are open, and you go and you get as much food as you possibly can that's not available in Lafayette, Indiana. Mm-hmm. So we would go to, for example, Froboni's on the way out of town, stop by Steve's and pick up some wines and beers that weren't available. And it was like we felt like Santa Claus every time we did that. You know, we'd come back, it's like, oh, hey, brought you a loaf of bread here, brought you this, you know, this red wine from Spain. I mean, it's changed. They've got much more. There's much more in Lafayette now than there was in those days. But it was really stark contrast, and that seeps down into to the basics of your. Of your life pretty fast. You get pretty used to that. Mm-hmm. So there's a big difference in every way. I mean, personally, intellectually, professionally, it was a huge difference.
You talked indirectly, although I'm not sure whether you used the word mentor, of two of the professors at UT Austin.
Yeah.
Were there other mentors or professors, maybe not even professors, folks who you see as mentors in your career?
Oh yeah, and it was, it's in some ways it's an environment that I think I still consciously work on recreating in part. As I said last time that in certain ways with graduate students, it takes a village. And I mean, I came to graduate school a complete unwashed hick. I mean, there were people starting when I started who had gotten their undergraduate degrees at Harvard and Oberlin and places like that. And I was pretty happy that I knew that Harvard was located near Boston, Massachusetts. You don't get from being a hick who's willing to do whatever it takes in terms of hard work to getting there. Without a huge amount of help from a huge number of people. And, you know, grad school was different in those days because there was sort of more social distance, more formality, less immediate contact. You know, I was not texting my professors. But at the same time, within those limits, there was a very clear sense that, I mentioned Bolognese and Lehmann last time, but there was a whole set of people, most of the people who became my dissertation committee and others, some of whom I didn't really do classes with, who sort of provided that context. I mean, Hubert Heinen is the grandson of a famous Texas German hill country school teacher, was a medievalist in the department. You know, he was small town Texas guy, so that was somebody who, like, you know, could give me the, I know you're not from the big city, kid, so pay attention to this. I had to learn this the hard way myself, kind of advice. And Madison graduate, John Weinstock, who later became associate dean, was associate dean basically for my time down there, taught. Especially Old Norse, works on Norwegian, things like that. He was really important. But people that I didn't really have classes with or didn't work with particularly, Ralph Reed was a literature professor who was incredibly generous with time and advice. He wasn't even a linguist, and he, like, you know, like, here's how you do it, kid. Frank Donahue was the teaching coordinator, had been a New York City cop and had gone to graduate school, and was just really revamping the teaching of lower division undergraduate German in remarkable ways. And he was incredibly helpful and supportive and generous with his time. The dean at the time was a linguist from the linguistics department who did his degree here, Robert D. King. King is Bob is politically at the opposite end of the spectrum from me, and I was involved in student politics as a graduate student. It was clear to all concerned that we were on opposite sides of things, but King had the classic kind of Southern political mentality of. We can fight like cats and dogs over the politics, but we can still be sports about it otherwise. walking across campus one day. He was also famously foul-mouthed in many situations. I was walking across campus one day, and he walks up to me, and he puts his arm around my shoulder. He's like, "Oh my God, what has happened now?" "Salins, I tell you what." "So, well, what's that, Dean King?" "So, I want you in a faculty senate meeting to get up and say something outrageous." "Well, Dean King, I think I do that about every meeting I attend, don't I?" "I said, yeah, but we'll figure out something good for you to say that's outrageous." "I said, yeah? And then I'm going to get up and agree with you." "I said, what?" "I said, everybody in the room is going to shit their pants." And then he just walks away. It's a complete, like, just classic Texas political moment. But, you know, I never had a class with him, but we co-authored something together a few years ago, an obituary, in fact, for Lehman. But they were the people who informed that, you know, who created that environment and made it. And I think with the people I worked with, all of them knew that they didn't know everything, and they were very good about saying, "Oh no, for this you want to talk to so and so, you know, and see what so and so thinks about this." It was a really rich environment, and tons of other graduate students. I mean, like, it's a list too long to go through.
Mm-hmm. So, and again, you've talked about this, you know, even as you started the answer to this question, but I wonder if you would speak directly to being mentored and now being a mentor, how you feel you try to pay that forward.
That's a question I ask myself every single morning. And it's something that Monica and I talk about constantly. So Monica wrote a book, I can show you a copy of it later, called Surviving Linguistics, basically a guide for graduate students. And started out, we at Purdue with another colleague, Becky Brown, we realized that our students, so in graduate school, we had all learned, how do you write an abstract? How do you write a conference paper? How do you present a conference paper? And you just go and find another older graduate student, and you start getting advice, and then eventually maybe you get input from your professors and stuff. And at Purdue, we realized that there wasn't that culture in our departments, and so we started working to build it. And so we had this whole set of materials called How to Write Like a Linguist, and it turned into Surviving Linguistics. But a huge part of that, obviously, is how you acculturate people, how you get people who, you know, whatever their parents do, their parents are not academics in almost every case. And it's a culture with a lot of tradition, and you have to learn your way into that, not just in the mechanics, but also in sort of how to think about it. And seriously, I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't think seriously about how you mentor students. In fact, Monica and I just wrote a grad contract. So, okay, a new student comes and wants to work with you. We both had developed over the years a spiel for, okay, look, you're going to work with me. Here's what you can expect from me. Here's what I'm going to expect from you. And we actually kind of wrote that up, saying, okay, you give me something to read, I will get it back to you very quickly. Like, unless there's something weird going on, I will get it back to you within a couple of days. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to submit a conference abstract to a major conference unless I've had a look at it, because I want to make sure you don't screw up, and you want to make sure you don't screw up. But the thing that makes it such a complex challenge is that what it takes to work with every single student is different. Because of what the students bring to the table, how they think and work, and ultimately what they're trying to get out of it. I've got and have had graduate students who want to be, you know, the next Noam Chomsky, basically. I've had graduate students who want to go to a small liberal arts college and teach. I've had graduate students who don't want to be academics at all, but want to get a PhD for whatever reason. And I think one of the hardest things is to is to get out of this sort of cloning mentality of all my students should be what I am. And once you sort of break free from that, it becomes easier. So it's a negotiation, but it's also, again, a community process. I mean, you don't, and that's one of the strongest things I think about the Texas experience as I lived it, that you don't get your input from one source. You look at how a kid acquires language. They start out talking like their parents and the people who live in the household, but by pre-adolescence, they have not only been in contact with other speakers normally, they have adjusted their speech very dramatically. So, you raise kids in Madison, Wisconsin, it doesn't matter if you and your wife are from Idaho, your kids are gonna grow up with basically a Madison accent. And it's that, in German, the word for doctoral advisor is Doktorvater, the doctor father, doctoral father. So you can stretch the parental thing like maybe you have a central role in guiding, but they are not going to end up the same way, and you don't want it, right? You don't want that that cloning process. It's not good for anybody. So, but it's seriously like every I think even in the summer I'm reading stuff from especially doctoral students every couple of days, and it's always this sort of what's going to be the most constructive way to do this, is how much feedback is going to be valuable without overloading them, how much explicit guidance should I give them, how much should I argue for them to adopt a particular position. So, they're, especially in linguistics, like I said, typical in a lot of social sciences probably, there are a lot of programs in linguistics where if you study with so-and-so, then you know exactly what theory they're using, you know exactly what data they're using. That's not how it works for me, and it's not how it works for most of us here, because I mean, if you work with me and you work in another framework, or you're working with a data set that is not one that I normally use, then you're going to have to answer a lot of questions. We're going to have a lot of discussions about that, but it's perfectly fine. But there's always this question of like, well, do I want to push them more toward this position on this, or do I just want to sort of push a little bit and see how well they've got it down? Mm-hmm. And that really, I think that goes back to being a philosophy major, where the mantra all the time outside of logic classes, where there is a right and a wrong, and to a certain extent, okay, I don't care what position you take on this, so we're talking about some basic issue in ethics or something. there's a wide range of legitimate positions on this. The question is how well you defend the position, how well can you articulate the position. And I think we have to do that in linguistics. I mean, I've got a pretty clear sense of what, how best to move linguistic theory forward today, but it's not it's certainly not the only way, and it could be entirely wrong. It could be that in 5 years the bottom falls out in the way I think about stuff. I don't think it's likely to happen at this point. Mm-hmm. So.
I assume you've been here long enough now that there are graduate students that you advised that are now in the field.
Oh, yeah.
I know doing this, there's always the risk that you miss lauding someone, but I'm wondering if there are grad students that you are particularly either working with or you know of their work and they do have done great things.
Yeah, I mean, I still work basically with almost all of the students that I mentored. I mentioned Dan Witzel from Purdue. We were working together on projects when he had a heart attack. I mean, not at that moment, but in that week. In some cases, it's co-authorship. So Ava Yatsevich, I can give you spellings and stuff, is in speech science at Ohio State. She had, with her boss, Rob Fox, had come up with some ideas about understanding how vowels work that let themselves be tested really nicely with vowel change, dialect change data. And so they got a National Institutes of Health grant for 5 years, and we got a bunch of very nice papers out of that. I mentioned last time Miranda Wilkerson, who did the immigrant language, immigrants learning English stuff. I didn't direct her dissertation, but we worked together on that. Felicia Lucht is at Wayne State. And we've co-authored stuff, and the Wisconsin Talk volume that is just about to come out in probably 6 weeks, it will exist as a physical object. She has a chapter in that. She's working on her on a book right now that she'll finish up this summer or fall. But it's not always a case of co-authorship. Laura Catherine Smith is at BYU. And we co-authored right after she got to BYU, but she's been doing more work on especially second language acquisition lately, and so we're not co-authoring, but we're in constant contact and talking about stuff. So I continue to benefit from those students and from what they know and what they do long after they've left. And even people who don't go into academia, Dave Holzinger did a dissertation on phonology, historical phonology, and got a postdoc in Berlin, decided that it was too far away from his better half, and went into the computer industry. But we co-authored stuff after he was out of academia, and we're still in contact about this. He still knows and thinks about language in interesting ways. What he does is voice recognition and localization for speech applications, things mm-hmm. like GPS systems and stuff like that. So connects in interesting ways. Can learn a lot from a person like that. Mm-hmm. So, and it's really only a few of them, but yeah, every single case, I think there's some ongoing real connection.
Okay. There's a couple other things I want to ask, but I think I will say that maybe we'll do our last interview will be the potpourri category from Jeopardy. So maybe we'll start the university service, which you talked about last time indirectly. Maybe we'll start it by going back to graduate school, because you said that you were politically active at UT Austin.
Yeah.
So maybe the question is, why did you choose to be politically active there?
Well, I think you... it is... You know, everybody is so... excited about democracy, but successful democracy depends on having people who understand, have some reasonable understanding of the situation that they're dealing with. The way that you get that is education. The way that you get economic mobility, social mobility, is education. Not in every single case, and obviously there's a set of tech people who didn't go to college, and in some cases I guess didn't finish high school. But and really the reliable ladder to get up in the world, in this world, is higher education. And I My family background is really mixed in a way. My mother's family, a couple of generations ago, were sharecropping cotton and tobacco in eastern North Carolina. My mother had an 11th grade education. And my father had gone to college, some of his family had was educated as well. But I still grew up living in nothing but house trailers until I was in fourth grade. And my father left about the same time. And even for the people in the neighborhood I grew up in who lived in nicer houses, the real world was very, very close. Every single one of us, I mean, I never lacked for food or clothes or anything, which is how you count poor in that world. If somebody got sick, they got to go to the doctor, things like that. But every single one of us knew people who didn't have those luxuries. And by the time you get to graduate school, if you're living in that world, by the time you get to graduate school, you realize that there are people around you whose lives were fundamentally different in terms of privilege. And you start to realize, why is it that I'm in a situation where I could move into a much more comfortable life, whereas a bunch of the people I went to high school with are very unlikely to find that opportunity. It's education. It's having that chance and taking advantage of it. It cost me $200 a semester as an undergraduate. I never paid more than $400 as a graduate student. That means you can work a fast food job if you don't mind living in a dump, and I didn't mind living in a dump. You can work a fast food job or do some crap job like that and get by. And you could even get by, and this is unthinkable for students today, you could get by basically without debt, without long-term debt. Mm-hmm. And even by the early 80s, it was clear that that we could not take support for accessible, affordable higher education, quality higher education, for granted. And Austin was a pretty political, UT is a pretty political place. It was a time, I think, where there was an awareness of the need to be active. If you don't participate in democracy to the fullest extent that you have the chance, then you got nobody to blame but yourself. There was in Germanic languages at Austin, graduate student group in the department prided itself on sending representatives to faculty meetings. And somebody asked one time at a meeting at the beginning of a grad student meeting, well, do we have a vote? And the woman who was running the meeting said, vote? Of course we don't have a vote. I said, but why do we go? Because we have screaming rights. And in fact, it turns out that you could change, you could shape things in certain ways by participating, not screaming, but by participating in certain ways. The Council of Graduate Students was the grad student equivalent of the Student Senate, provided that same kind of opportunity in a way. And there were real issues. I mean, it was a different world. You know, you think about benefits for teaching assistants, you know, health insurance and things like that. That was a dream. I mean, we spent a lot of time, unsuccessfully, working to get health benefits for teaching assistants in Texas. Those battles are won later. I mean, those are days when was TAA formed?
TAA was formed in 60, somewhere in the 60s. The first strike was 1970.
1970, yeah. So the TAA was still relatively young.
Yeah.
In those days. that's the motivation. It was not, you know, storming the barricades or pitchforks and torches, but sort of how do you get in, how do you sort of push things in the right direction. It's the King quote that Obama gives sometimes, that the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. So what can we do to bend it in the right direction? And for me, that's a fundamental, that's like a core, it's a core value that high quality, affordable public education has to be there. I think that's a pillar of a successful society. Take that away, and we're way too close to feudalism.
So now let's push this forward. Unless there are things at your time at Purdue in terms of service, but let's talk about getting here. You know, you come here on a campus that's imbued with the Wisconsin idea, something that you embrace. I mean, it's easy to see in the interview and a half now that we've done. But what sort of things did you do initially or over the long term to become involved in service?
Well, the first thing, in a way, was there's an institute on campus called the Moscata Institute for German American Studies. It focuses on the German immigrant population and the descendants of those people. And as someone who works on German in the United States, I ended up being asked to direct it. And that was really my first intense engagement with the question of how do you, you know, how does an academic find useful ways to work with the public of the state, people who don't have a particular connection to the university in a lot of cases. When I became director of the institute in the late 90s, I'd been here long enough that I sort of knew the landscape. It wasn't completely foreign. Started doing some field work. That's how we first started doing new recordings of German speakers. I hadn't had real chances or a forum to organize that. And that's when I first started doing outreach talks. You know, what's an institute like that supposed to do? Well, one of the things it's supposed to do is to research, documenting the dialects is a piece of that, doing archival research is a piece of that. But it's got to, if it's going to mean anything, it's got to engage with the people of the state. And it's amazing. You know, you can call up, just, you know, look around where the areas of German settlement are in this state, you know, you start calling people in Wausau or Beaver Dam or Sheboygan or Manitowoc or just fill in the blank and say, you know, if you'd be interested in a talk about the German language newspapers and magazines that were published in your part of the state, we'd be happy to come out and give one. And, you know, you can go to Mayville and have 60 people show up on a Tuesday night in the summer. It's amazing. Think about that. That's not, the whole country is not like that. And you can talk for 45 minutes and end up spending 2 or 2.5 hours with people asking questions and telling you things. Sometimes, you know, another example of something you know, but a lot of times something that either you didn't know or something that makes you think and makes you work differently. I gave the example last time of this stuff on immigrants learning English. It was, you know, a literal question. My grandfather learned English without any help when he came to Manitowoc. Well, did he really? I mean, I don't know when that was, 2002 or something. So for the last 12 years, I've been exploring that question, which turned out to be, whether that particular story is right or not, the question is a big one. I think that was really a pivotal point in terms of thinking about what the Wisconsin idea meant in practice. And you get to know very quickly people. This campus is rich in people like you, who know how to engage in all sorts of ways that I had no concept of at the time. And so I got to know a bunch of people at the State Historical Society, Jack Holzhieder and Jim Danke and people like that. And you know, the weirdest little things happen when you're doing stuff. So Smokey's Ivory, who I talked about last time, in the 40s, when he came back, he didn't just go and interview German speakers. He got a little, it's a cube, a little over a foot each way, that's a portable recorder called a Soundscriber. It makes records, 45s. And Smokey passed away not too long after I became director of the Moscata Institute. And we knew his family. And one day his daughter came by, Suzanne Treichel, lives in Milwaukee now. They were cleaning out his house, and she says, so we found this in Dad's attic. I don't know if it's of any interest to you, but it's a couple of boxes of stuff. If you don't want it, just throw it out. What is it? And, oh, I'm here. And I helped her bring it in from the car. So boxes. We have them right down the hall here. Boxes of his notebooks, field transcriptions. He was transcribing the speech as it happened. But it also included the Soundscriber that he used, the machine that he used to record in the 1940s, and it included all of his records. Those are, and we're doing the acoustic analysis of those records right now. As, this week, yesterday, a student, a graduate student, was working to transcribe one of his recordings. She's going to use the data for her dissertation. But we got these things. And you know what a Soundscriber disc looks like, plastic, flexible, and clearly a record. But you think about it, if you don't know what it is and you're handed a stack of these and you realize the first one, I pulled out one, it was, you know, date of recording, November 1948. Oh my God. And you start going through and you look at the places. Leads, just, I knew what we had, but I didn't know what the medium was. Like, is this 33 and a third? Is it 78? Do I just pop it on with a modern needle? Does it need, is that going to destroy the record? What do I do? So, a grad student at the time, Steve Geiger, and I were pondering this. And finally somebody said, Jesus, Joe, you know what you're supposed to do. That may have been Jim Leary for all I know. So you know what you do in this situation. No, I got no idea. That's why I'm sweating. Is take one of the things over to the Mills Music Library, and they will know what to do with it because they know every kind of recorded material that there is. So we walk in, I don't even remember who it was. It was a staffer at the time. And it's, well, what can I do for you? Well, we've got a whole set of these, and we don't know, we know what they are, and we know what's, in general terms, what's on them, but we don't know how to play them, whether it would damage them or not. And the guy says, oh, that's easy. He pops it out, walk into, you know, turntables are still pretty common at that point, walk into a room filled with turntables, plops it down on a turntable, sets it sets it up, and puts a needle on it. And the first thing we hear is Smokey's voice, who's been dead for a couple of years now, as a young man, saying in German, okay, now it's working. So, tell me your name and when you were born. And it's in German, so the guy who's the staffer doesn't understand it. And the guy says, well, my name is blah, blah, blah. And I was born, I don't remember what, say September the 19th. 1867. Whoa, we're listening to the voice of somebody who was born in 1866. Anyway, it was some matter of months after Appomattox, and Steve and I just like look at each other and our jaws drop, and the guy's sitting there like, what? He picks up the needle and we explain it to him. Yeah, it's the kind of stuff you get. So you know, not every place has that opportunity. I mean, we could have sat on that for, I mean, eventually we would have started calling and writing people, but, you know, the fact that we were able to resolve that so fast and so cleanly. So what do we do? Oh, well, just, you know, make sure you've got a good needle, and, you know, don't play them often. So don't worry, we're playing them once, digitizing, done. Which was a digitizing records was, as you know, a non-trivial thing in those days, and we were already involved with all these cassettes and reel-to-reels that we had inherited. So, so you start learning what's happening in the state, what people in the state are interested in, and in terms of languages, the Wisconsin Talk Book is really an attempt to put together. It grows out of exactly that time and that effort. What issues about language are of concern and value to real people in the state of Wisconsin? You know, why is it that, you know, is the English we speak here influenced by German immigrants? Why is it that African Americans speak so differently from white people? Why is it that Native American languages are endangered? And why are people so committed to revitalizing? On and on and on. Is Spanish going to displace English? What's happening with Hmong in the state? So real questions, and that's when we started. Groups of us started working and trying to figure it out. But it also, at the same time, it's back to the three-legged stool thing. You have to find the group of people here. You have ways that's going to influence your teaching, change your teaching fundamentally, and all of that. So that was really the opening there. And there's also an opening more generally, because, you know, you start as a director of a center, you start going to an institute, you start going to chairs and directors meetings, and start seeing how the deans are thinking about things, and start thinking, it changes how you think about what's happening on campus administratively. I mean, the one thing I always knew was that I didn't want to become an administrator, but that doesn't mean it's not extremely valuable to know how administrators are thinking or what they're doing.
So we talked about, well, actually you talked about with Joni, you did an interview with Joni Juster Hill in early spring 2011, and you talked about profs.
Yeah.
How long had you been involved in profs?
Profs was something that came ultimately from the connections through the Moscata Institute, that again, being getting out and getting to know people from that. I'm not sure why I was invited to join the steering committee, but I was invited to join the steering committee. I jumped on it for the obvious reasons of, you know, the reasons that one is engaged beyond your own office. Again, I just sat and listened for a long time to what was happening and how other faculty members understood the political process. And I didn't even go on a lot of what the Public Representation Organization of the Faculty Senate does is meet with members of state government, occasionally federal government, to talk to them about UW-Madison issues. And I didn't even go on a lot of visits in those days. They were, you know, most of the people there were much more senior, much more involved, much more knowledgeable. But eventually I started doing some of those. And you start to see, okay, you know what it's like to go to Sheboygan on a Wednesday night and talk to a room full of people about the German dialects that were spoken in Sheboygan County. It's a very different perspective to go and see what a representative from somewhere outstate thinks about UW and UW funding. And it brings, as often happens with different perspectives, it brings some real differences to the fore. So I was pretty excited and upbeat about the Wisconsin idea and about this chance to connect. But you start seeing that it's maybe it's not as not as robust or as well practiced as it could be, and you start to see that that there are people in state government who understand and appreciate the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and there are people who root for the football team. Mm-hmm. It's a complex set of questions that I don't understand that landscape even today, but I learned more from being involved in profs.
Maybe one last thing for today, and that's you talked yesterday about how your graduate students work, or your relationship with graduate students start because they usually are a TA. They come in as a TA for a class.
Yeah.
So what, if any, relationship did you have with the TAA between 95 and 2010?
A number of my students, people I've already mentioned, like Dave Holzinger, were very active in the TAA. And was it 2000 the year of the grade in?
I'm not sure.
It was somewhere in there. That was around the time that Dave finished. There was a big grade in. So the German department, of course, Biddy Martin in the early days of the TAA was very, not the earliest days, but the sort of early critical days. It was a very active member. The German department's always been very involved in the TAA, and down to the present day, I have graduate students who are stewards and have been stewards. And I think one of the basics that a faculty member has to think about and deal with is the working conditions of their teaching assistants and project assistants. You know that you're not going to make a lot of money. It's not a career choice. But at the same time, you see every day how much of the core work, the real hands-on work of the university, is done by teaching assistants, project assistants, and research assistants. And you want those people to have the best possible environment to do that. Because in language departments, TAing for a class means this is your section of Spanish 204 or French intermediate conversation or German 101 or second year Dutch, and you're responsible for it. You have to do everything. And having been through that process, I know how hard it is, and I want kids coming from, you know, La Crosse or Eau Claire to UW-Madison, when they take German 101, I want them to have extremely good instruction, because maybe in 5 years they're going to end up in my intro grad course. And at the very least, they're going to be out there in the world as somebody who's had German at UW-Madison. So having them have the best possible working conditions is something to be valued. So from at the time of the grade in, went to a few TAA rallies and marches just to show support. And again, it's the, you know, you're not going to bend the arc yourself, but like one more person out there, one more voice, you have to do the piece that you can do. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think, it's just in the non-political sense, a thing of solidarity. You work with these people closely, you value what they do, and you want to make sure that they understand that you value what they do. And I think that's that sort of thing is important. So it was later with the Coalition for Affordable Public Education that I had sort of more general ties to the TAA. With CAPE, that was really closely affiliated with the TAA, but involved a lot of faculty who were interested in exactly these issues. It had been a concern for me basically forever of how do we keep high quality public education accessible and affordable to people. And you know, so Kate met for a long time, still meets occasionally, but met for a long time every single week, year round, and talked about what we could do in terms of especially graduate students, issues like tuition remission, TA salary, things like that.
Joe, I want to stop here for today. Okay. I want to give you the last word if, in case there's anything on your mind that you want to get off your chest. At least there's probably a lot on your mind that you want to get off your chest, but maybe more focused on what we've been talking about today. How about that?
No.
Okay.
It's all one big opportunity to get stuff off my chest in a sense.
Joe, well, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Sure.